In that case, because we've built this trust and honesty with each other, I never feel like I'm in a position where I'm placating you or trying to assuage your ego or any of those
No.
things. So we can be completely honest and really do
Yeah.
the work. Kel is someone that I've been working with on a regular basis, doing one-on-one coaching in the area of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And through that, I now very proudly call her my friend, too.
Yeah, same here.
So I like to kick off these conversations with a little meet cute. How we met, which is kind of a funny question to ask us because we technically have never met in person, which is sad.
It is sad. I will say I'm going to be in Chicago, it looks like in May. So hopefully we'll actually get to see
Oh,
each other in person soon.
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the conveniences is that we can do this work online together and see each other. But yes, one of the things we haven't gotten to do yet is meet in person. So I hope that happens in May. But so I'd love to hear your meet cute version of how we online met anyways.
Yeah, sure. So, one of my best friends is a theater director and activist named Jess McLeod, who was based in Chicago for 12 years. And we talk about everything all the time. And this kind of goes into you and I talking about how I came to this work. But so, yeah, she knew some things that were going on in my consulting work, and she went ahead and was just really great and was like, I know a really awesome DEI expert that I think, as I said, that I was looking for some support, and she's the one who connected us.
Share with everyone a little bit of what your background is and what you
Sure.
meant in terms of, you don't have to get into specifics, but the challenges you may have been having.
So I a little bit of background on me is I was a theater director for 20 years. And as anybody in the theater industry knows, being an emerging theater director doesn't really pay any money. So I ended up working as a fundraiser over the phone for a theater I thought I wanted to run someday. I got really good really fast. I was really successful, and it was this like survival job. So I
Yes.
ended up with this parallel career as a fundraiser, and that became I started to teach other people how to do it. And so I found myself in this place as a fundraising consultant and trainer, and that was my parallel career to being a director. Pandemic hit, wasn't directing, started fundraising full time, and realized I was happier not doing my favorite thing. Who would have thought? So I was fundraising full time while we were in shutdown, and I realized that I really liked it. So I made a full career transition to becoming a fundraiser, becoming a fundraising consultant, coach, trainer, and speaker. And so we started to run into some challenges as I was doing this on a larger scale of people over the phone not always behaving well, like saying things that weren't appropriate, that were racist, every other ist we can think of. So I started to try to do some research and try to understand what do we do to cultivate anti-racism, anti-discriminatory practices with customer service.
To just kind of, I wanted to also sprinkle in a little detail based on our work together, which is part of the challenge you encountered in these calls where you were really striving to have rooms that were diverse, giving opportunity, especially to artists looking for supplemental income. You wanted a diverse room making these calls. And pair that when you're doing fundraising for a theater, often you're calling customers who have seen the previous season and either loved or hated what they saw. And if it's a theater who's attempting to do provocative work, whatever it might be, there might be things that address or talk about issues of marginalized groups in ways that some audiences might not be comfortable. So that's where some of that
Exactly.
conflict really came up, right? Where it was like somebody making a call and they start to get feedback from this person about the previous season, and this person may or may not even be aware that they're speaking to a a marginalized person.
Exactly.
And racism and all sorts of, as you said, isms and ists and
isms and ists. Yeah, exactly.
Isms and ists. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you sort of went to Jess and were like, I'm not finding this, I'm looking for this, can you articulate specifically the support that you were looking for or that you shared with Jess?
I think that I was coming from a place of this needs a set of tools that I don't have right now. And I, you know, I'm white, cis, hetero, like I'm only going to be able to even build the toolbox that I'm going to be able to build based on my identity. But I knew enough to know that there was more work for me to be, for me to do. And I think it's coming from a place of, you know, I had read, there's this great book called Decolonizing Wealth by Edgar Villanueva. It's just like really having big conversations about how to make the space more inclusive and more expansive for everybody. And basically, how do we like truly decolonize and pull out of white supremacy, which is really hard. That's all very much embedded in the philanthropic practices in our country.
Can you recall where you were in your DEI journey when we first met? Because you were already on a journey. So, and for me, that's important in the one-on-one coaching dynamic, to work with somebody who is in somewhere on the path, or at least is aware that they're at the very beginning of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I learned very quickly that there was work that you'd already done. Can you share a little bit about where you were?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I had probably, I don't know, maybe like early 2019, I'd read White Fragility. Like, I think a lot of white people, that's where we start. So I'd been doing some readings before Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd were murdered in 2020. Like, I'd been starting some of that work and honestly had been, you know, I'm fine to be really frank with you and your audience, like was in a place as a theater director of where do I fit and what are the things I'm directing? Should I be directing some of the things that I'm directing? Before the racial reckoning, you know, really kind of came into full swing in 2020, I was already having thoughts about like, I'm not feeling good about some of the things that I'm directing and I'm being asked to direct. And that was really where it started.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I definitely found myself, you know, during the pandemic and during 2020 into 2021, I was reading more things, having more conversations, listening to more podcasts, watching more documentaries, like doing a lot of like research, I'd say, but it was more passive. Maybe not totally passive. I mean, I really did start to, particularly with some of my white female friends, start to have conversations and groups and accountability within one another that I started kind of doing independently and felt right. I knew enough to know that that was not for my BIPOC friends, colleagues, and family members to be teaching me and to be doing that level of work. So I still didn't quite have all the tools, but I knew enough to start to have those conversations.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. So one thing I just want to have like a little sidebar conversation around white fragility, because I don't know whether you know sort of where that book is right now in the conversation.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
So
but let's talk about it.
Yeah. Maybe. So for those listening, there's been, you know, Robin DiAngelo is a white cisgender woman. As far as I know, I have not heard that from her mouth, but I believe that is to be true. She wrote this book, White Fragility, which for a while now has been sort of that first step for folks who are interested in being anti-racist and inclusive. Around the time of all of these events happening in George Floyd, a lot of Black content creators and folks who have been doing this type of teaching started to really draw attention to the fact that the book itself is problematic because it centers whiteness.
totally.
Right. And then there's this other thing happening with Robin DiAngelo, which is this has become her life's work. She's made her speaking, her ask for speaking engagements is like in the 20,000s at least, I believe. Don't quote me, but I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah.
Making all this money. And then somewhere on her website, it's like, a good portion of this is donated to such and such causes, but there's no receipts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people really just started to call attention to that.
Yeah.
And so that book has sort of gone down on the list. In fact, I've taken it off my list in terms of books that I recommend. Because the messaging there, I think in some ways is important, but is not comprehensive enough, or maybe deeply as thought out as it needs to be. So but the great thing is whether that becomes the first book someone reads or not, there are so many others.
Totally.
You know, if it's a journey, that means it's not just going to be a one and done thing. But I just wanted to sort of, you know, talk about that.
I appreciate that you bringing that up.
Yeah. So in our work together, then, I think when we first met, there were these sort of pressing issues happening in the online rooms that you were working with, and some organizational stuff happening with some of the companies that you were working with. And I remember a lot of it was you coming from a place of real concern that the things that you were observing that were happening weren't even sort of in the periphery of the folks who actually were in charge.
Yeah.
And folks within your online rooms, seeking support, needing protection, not in that sort of like white savior kind of way, but like needing protection in terms of, how do I handle when someone says something awful? Do I have to continue, even in scripting?
Yes.
Do I have to continue this conversation?
Mm-hmm.
What am I supposed to say or do? So as we started our work together, do you kind of recall what sort of one of your first big sort of aha moments were? Or when things started to kind of track or connect for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it was a lot of conversation between you and me of just explaining what happens in these phone calls.
Yeah.
And I mean, because it's something, if you've never done it, and I do this in a way, I call it outbound fundraising. So it's not like telefundraising, telemarketing. It's, you know, very much more like, I like to think that it's more holistic, and it's about relationship building as opposed to like an transactional encounter. And so it really is about building community by one-on-one relationships. So yeah, we're kind of also inviting these conversations, like somebody to open up in this way on these conversations. So I think something that you and I collaborated and that you just had such like expertise and wisdom on early on, Tanya, was what to say in a moment if anything happened on the call that just instinctually, I try to be really broad about this, that it's not about what's explicitly said. It can just be about a feeling and just telling that fundraiser if they're getting a bad feeling, if they're instinctually not feeling safe, if they feel like this is going down a path that is not going to be safe for them, that they can truly just say at any moment, you know, I'm going to end this phone call, to end this conversation right now, and give you back the rest of your day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Simple.
Very simple. And I think so empowering in the sense that so often all people need is that permission, because, you know, in any individual's life, if they were to encounter that sort of stress or tension or dynamic, they would hopefully advocate for themselves. But they're in this circumstance where they're at work, they're doing a job, and they don't know if they were to do that under the umbrella of this job, whether the culture they're in encourages or values that, right? So like the first step is make it clear, right? Communicate to them, this is what you can do. This is an option that we are giving you. So you don't have to feel as if you're breaking some kind of a rule or expectation if you do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember that as well being a kind of a big moment, and the truth of it being what we often find in these conversations is how simple it can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another thing, and we can come back to this, but I think in our work, I continue to learn to be even more intentional with my words, and that tends to be something that we continue to go back to, and the importance and the power for good and the power for harm of words and the specificity of language.
Yes.
And I love that. Everyone I work with is either, in terms of these outbound fundraisers, they're all either artists or art administrators. And so I always say that I'm invested in them as human beings first, artists second, and fundraisers third.
That's so huge. And I remember, especially in 2020, that is something that became sort of a refrain for me, which is especially with the sort of the reckoning that happened within the theater industry and the We See You document, which was all of these artists, finally marginalized artists, finally putting together a document of expectations about how they wanted to be treated forward in equitable and inclusive ways. And one thing the drum I really started to beat then, and when I was working in rehearsal rooms, was human beings first.
Yeah.
We are human beings first. Yeah. And that was not even on the radar. Talk to me a little bit about, and, you know, those moments when you've come to me thinking that you've made a mistake or an error in an interaction, and what that experience is like when, and just to sort of emphasize, you know, Kel comes to me sometimes from a vulnerable place because she's sharing something that she feels might have been a misstep, but we've established a trust and a sort of no judgment zone where she can come to me and say, I think I might have fucked this up a little bit. And then we unpack it together in a way that either confirms that or gets you to think of it another way.
But
even in those moments when we're quote unquote confirming it, it's not from a shame place. It's more from a, this is what it is. These are the factors that were in place that made it seem as if that would be the natural response or whatever. And here's how we don't let it happen again, or, you know, but also we can decide in that moment, is it something to circle back on? Is it something to just hold with the discomfort that that might create? Right. All that stuff. But anyway, so back to what the question was, which was, can you speak to that, those moments or anything you recall?
Yeah. I mean, I think I definitely was really nervous when we first started to work together and was like, and again, coming from a more performative place of how do I show this potential EDI coach who's Black, how do I show her that like I mean the best? And I'll say, like, what I got from you really early on, Tanya, was a real vulnerability back. And like in my first meeting, I hadn't, again, very much like centering myself as the white person, wasn't thinking about what that means, what that could potentially mean for you as a DEI coach who's Black with a white woman that you don't know and being in conversation. And so there was a certain vulnerability that I felt from you at the get-go that, again, back to our point of like ultimately human to human, that I was like, okay, I started to like reframe that in my head as opposed to like how I don't need to like get an A from you. I don't need to prove myself to you. Like I know now. And through our work, I'm getting really clearer and more comfortable with the fact that I will mess up. And I will be on this journey my entire life and hopefully someday be an 85-year-old woman who's been on this journey for decades and decades and decades.
Yes.
And I will say and do the wrong thing. Like I am comfortable with that now. And it's helping me be a better ally because I'm less concerned about the moments when I will misstep and knowing that those will happen. And so just like accepting that is making it easier for me to be vocal and for me to continue to move forward. And I'll say, like, you're so great at what you do that you're right. Sometimes it is like we have a conversation. I'm like, oh, I think I really messed this up. And I tell you something and you're like, yeah, you really messed that up. More often than not, though, it's a much more complicated, complex, I'll say, conversation. And I'll say that our work, you know, if I think about what our work is like, it's like, you know, I have a lot of people in my life that I like truly go to as like part of my counsel in terms of like, and I really do look at like all areas of my life, my business, my personal life, like they're all connected. It's all interconnected. Right. I really try to like embrace my life from a holistic place of it's not like I put on one hat and take off the other. So
So
there's work I do with you.
Right.
There's work I do with my therapist.
Mm-hmm.
There's work I do with my business coach, and you're all experts that I hire and spend time with. And there is overlap in all three of those areas.
Yes.
And that feels good. And it feels exciting. And it feels like you said, there's unpacking. I mean, in our last session, there was a moment when I was like really kind of blaming something that happened on what I felt was like unearthing my own white supremacy. And then we talked about it more and realized that it was actually connected to something from my childhood that like wasn't about white supremacy. That was like truly about the environment in which I grew up.
Yes.
And so like that felt pretty powerful. And you really did hold me accountable. This is like kind of like almost the converse of what most of this work is. I kept wanting to go back to making it about unearthing the white supremacy. And you kept being like, no, no, no. Like, let's put that aside. Here's this other thing that was going on with you. And so who would have thought we'd be in a conversation and it would get to that? That it'd be like, and you showing compassion and empathy and patience for me healing something from my childhood. And knowing that, like sometimes there's even deeper levels that are passed to like the like unearthing the white supremacy to a place of like, oh no, this is something that you're healing from your own just individual life experience. That was pretty wild.
Thank you so much for alluding to that because obviously our work is confidential. So I wouldn't have been like, member win, but that was, I could get emotional because I found that to be such a powerful moment. And I felt such empathy for that child, right? And it was an interesting position for me to be in, to be like, no, no, no. That wasn't what. And then I think I made a joke almost like, is it white supremacy or is it trauma? You know, and how conscious we have to be in this work. Yeah. And I think it's important because I wasn't suggesting that to quote unquote, let you off the hook, if you want to. It was more like, I mean, it's very nuanced stuff, but sometimes if we make the mistake that it's one thing when it's the other, it becomes harder to identify when it is the white supremacy, right? Yeah. Like if we just decide... And I mean, white supremacy is inherent in everything we do. Even a lot of our childhood trauma comes from parental expectations that are framed through white supremacy, right? Mm-hmm. No matter where or how you were raised or what ethnicity you are. But it's just such a fine line about when to call yourself in about that and when not to. And the reason being... we just want to get as accurate as we can so that we really actually know what it feels like in our body when something is coming from trauma and something is coming from leaning into white supremacy in a way, because you could argue white supremacy is a form of trauma, but when we are leaning into white supremacy as a power play or to maintain an unhealthy dynamic with someone who culturally may seem to have less power or any of those things. So that was a really exciting and deep moment. And just what comes out of this, you know, that didn't come out of anything more than you doing a check-in about an interaction with someone, right? Mm-hmm. And then the result of that was sort of this excavation that was powerful for us both, right? And and that's the other end of this work, is that I learn a lot from Kel as well, right? And I, whether it is in terms of like refining whatever it is I'm trying to articulate, but also just sort of how you move through your life, how intentional and conscious you are, and how you come from such a place of humanity, you know. How does the work that we've been doing show up in your life in addition to your work? Like, and you already sort of made the point that you try not to sort of separate those things out, but just sort of how does it surface or come up for you?
All the time. Like, I mean, truly almost in a daily basis. I feel comfortable, more comfortable than most, articulating my thoughts and where I am on my journey. And I think like that's what I feel really empowered by our work is about, particularly in white spaces. I guess that's what I'm really learning, right? I'm learning in white spaces how to speak up and how to like make space, hold space for other white identifying folks to also be on their journey and to come to me with that. And I'm also learning, and this is one of the big ahas I've gleaned from our work, is like that I can actually say less when it comes to engaging with like my historically marginalized colleagues and friends. I can actually say less. Like the way to make more space is to say less.
Oh my God, that's so good.
It's truly the biggest, right? Like I'm learning how to use my voice in certain circles, and then other circles how to really like hold back and hold space. And that's
so good.
That's feeling really awesome. And I think another big thing, I think this came up last time we were together, and you can maybe you remember exactly how you said this, but you know, my instinct is to go in and fix. Like is to go in and fix, as you know, and we'll tell everybody else we're talking to, and to understand that that's also coming from a white supremacist place of like put on the Band-Aid, like put on like a new veneer, whatever that equals, but to like just kind of go from like let's just fix it as quickly as possible, as opposed to breathing into the discomfort and letting that live. So something else I'm really learning from you is to be able to say in those heightened moments, or if someone is coming to me, to realize, well, they're not coming to me to fix it. They're coming to me because I'm a trusted ally, and to just thank them for sharing where they are and feeling comfortable saying, I need a little bit of time to process this.
Yes.
And I think you said something like, did you say bad decisions don't wait?
Bad ideas. Yeah. Bad ideas can't wait.
Bad ideas can't wait. And that like really stays in my head in the biggest way. I'm just like, and like another thing, I could talk about this forever with you, but the other thing that something that you've really been helping me learn is how to breathe into discomfort.
Yes.
And like saying like when I'm watching a TV show with like cringe, to even just like practice at watching TV to be like, cool. Just watched, my husband and I watched The Curse on HBO, and that is hella cringe. And I just kept being like, practicing my DEI work as I'm watching this, of like letting the cringe just kind of flow through me and stay present and just like get comfortable with the cringe and get comfortable with not moving forward with the knee-jerk impulse I have.
Yeah. No, yes. Bad ideas can't wait is probably one of that's one of my favorite mantras. And the other favorite mantra is, and when you're making decisions, which choice is going to give you the least anxiety? Because the truth is, we so often want to make decisions based on, okay, who which one will gain the most approval, which one will put me in such and such light, versus which one of these decisions are going to give me the least bit of anxiety, heart palpitations, stress. Go with that. And the bad ideas can't wait one is really crucial when we're trying to be an ally and we want to rush into whatever that looks like for us, which could end up making things worse. One thing I wanted to also circle back on was when you said, you know, when we were talking about, like, sometimes I'll be like, oh, wait, no, that's not what you're saying it is. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, maybe that one you did that didn't quite land how you wanted it to. I feel like it's important too, though, that when we have those moments, we always are able to unpack it to the point where we trace it back to what led to that. Like, oh, that might be coming from, you know, our conditioning and white supremacy. That might be coming from a place of privilege that we can interrogate, right? Yeah. So that it's never just sort of like, or that might be coming from your default, which is let's try to fix this, which traces back to other things, but this is how it's showing up here. And so that being part of the work too. So it isn't just a like acknowledgement of like, oh, okay, maybe that wasn't the best choice, but then you can really look at it. So again, it can be applied in that next situation. Which is always, I think, important. Otherwise it's just like, it's not about being a confessional, right?
Totally.
It's about how do we take the information? How do we, digest it? And then how are we able to move forward and, make a different choice the next time?
Yeah. Well, you know? And I love that too. I mean, because it is always so much deeper. And so that, and I think maybe that's also why that's now become comfortable for me to share that with you. And because it's not like I come to you to quote unquote confess what I did or something.
Exactly.
Or then like, and for you to give me a prescribed way to correct it. Like the quote unquote course correcting is about like digging deeper into the muck. Like,
yes.
And that feels really good to just be like, all right, let's really identify. Let's talk about all of the given circumstances that were happening and the nuance behind those given circumstances. Let's talk about the words I used in that moment. Let's talk about why I had the impulse to do what I did in that moment. And then like, let's go a lot deeper to figure out like, what are we actually unearthing? And so to me, that's what it is. It's like, I just can always go back to the idea that I'm going to spend my life like digging out those white supremacist roots.
And the truth is that those white supremacist roots are in all of us. Like I never want to turn this into a sort of binary of like marginalized folks don't experience this, white people do. It's like, no, if we were raised in this culture, even with all our different cultures in our homes, white supremacy is pervasive throughout all of those contexts. Yeah. It's like pollution, right? And you can't see it, but it's there. And it's so important to realize that we are all victim of white supremacy.
Yeah.
But in being victims, there are things we can do. And we can challenge it. And help dismantle it. Well, this was brilliant. Where can people find you? What things related to the empire that you're building would you like to share?
I mean, I'm, like I said, I really am focusing on working with not-for-profits on empowering them to have 5-minute phone conversations predominantly with potential mid-level donors. And I've got a 5-minute fundraising ask training. That's basically, it's possible to have a 5-minute fundraising conversation that's about calling them in as community, as opposed to making them feel like ATMs. And I'm all about, I like to say that my catchphrase, it's the working title of the book I'm very slowly writing, taking the ick out of the ask.
Nice.
That asks don't have to be icky.
Kel, thank you so much.
Thank
this
you,
is Tanya. Awesome. We have another session in a, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks. I look forward to it.
Me too.
All right. We'll talk soon.